Lawyers for Barry George, the man wrongly imprisoned for murdering TV presenter Jill Dando, has lost his legal fight for compensation. He served 8 years in jail before being cleared at a retrial. Our reporter Tom Parmenter is at the High Court.
For those 8 years, Barry George wanted compensation for loss of earnings and for the taking of those 8 years from his life. But what the High Court has decided here is that he can no longer go further with that application.
A member of hospital staff has been suspended after a dummy was taped to a baby boy's face. The four-month-old wasn't harmed, but police and Mid-Staffordshire NHS Foundation Trust are investigating. Chancellor George Osborne has vowed not to run away from Britain's economic problems, following fresh signs the UK is heading for an unprecedented triple-dip recession. Figures from the Office for National Statistics show the economy shrank by 0.3% between October and December. Fuel prices are expected to rise by up to 4 pence a litre over the next week. The Petrol Retailers Association says this can add £2 to the cost of filling a typical family car. Brian Madison, chairman of RMI Petrol, which represents retailers, says they cannot understand why this is happening.
We have a glut of petrol amongst our refiners. We've probably had one of the worst January demand figures for motoring fuel for a long while because of the wintry weather and people sensibly kept their cars at home.
That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
What do you like?
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is former candidate for the Bristol Mayor, also a city councillor of both Labour and Conservative parties from the Save Filton Airfield campaign, Tim Collins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the World Economic Forum, the rich and powerful schmooze at the luxury Davos resort in Switzerland this weekend, there's no doubt. These are the people that really run the Western world. But who runs Davos? A highly critical article is removed yesterday from the Bloomberg website. We have a good look at that article. And the cuts are kicking up in Cadbury Heath. Post office and youth centre are the latest to fall under the axe. We hear from a local councillor up there. Plus, highly dangerous nuclear shipments passing through Bristol Temple Meads every week. Have you felt the warm glow on a Wednesday afternoon at the station platform? We hear from two nuclear train chasers. And the notorious death of government scientist David Kelly back in 2003. We hear from someone else who believes he was murdered. Barrister Michael Shrimpton gives us a possible nuclear-charged motive. Also, Egypt and other places, Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 degree Celsius and some heavy rain. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius, cloudier on Saturday with some light rain, sunnier on Sunday with some showers in the early morning. Next week, highs of 12 Celsius, a bit cloudy, but plenty of showers and also windy next week. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of February, highs of 6 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Tim Collins, who was a candidate for the Bristol Mayor back in November last year. Hi, Tim, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, Tim, tell us a little bit about your political past, because you have been both a Labour and a Conservative city councillor, haven't you, in the past?
I was an Avon County Council, actually. I did stand in Bristol Division Award, as you may know it. I was the first to join the Labour Party in 1983 for that famous general election when Michael Foot had the longest suicide note in history. So that was quite a left-wing stance I took in the Labour Party in those days. I then ran the Labour Party in Bristol from 1986 to 1988 as its secretary, District Labour Party, and in 1988 1989, I was selected as the Labour Party candidate for Southmead Ward, which I represented until 1993. However, I crossed the floor with 1 month of my term in office to go in 1993, joined the Conservative Party, didn't contest Southmead again, but the following year I stood in Eastfield for the next 3 years unsuccessfully as a Conservative candidate. Eastfield includes Stapleton, which used to be a Conservative seat for Jervis Walker, who ran Bristol and Avon. And subsequently, I stood for the Conservatives in St George East in 1997, which is now a Conservative seat, and Froome Vale in 1998, which is also a Conservative seat nowadays.
So the big question, looking at your background, is what caused you in 1993 to... you were secretary of the Labour group on the City Council, and you crossed the floor to become a Conservative. That's a pretty either bold or possibly reckless thing to do. Yeah. Suddenly, I mean, people have elected you as a Labour councillor, but you've decided, no, I don't want to be a Labour councillor, I'm going to be a Conservative.
Yeah, no. I was a secretary of Bristol Labour Party, 86 to 88. I then became an Avon County councillor. During my time in Avon County Council, the poll tax was introduced. And despite you would think it would be the wrong party to join, what I represented was one of Bristol's outlying estates. And those of us in the Labour group who represented the suburbs of Bristol, such as Southmead, Lochlea, Whitchurch Park, we argued within the group to keep the poll tax as low as possible, so we would have effectively a zero increase on the budget, just allow for inflation, and not punish the people who'd never had to pay poll tax before, which tended to be people in the outlying council estates. However, the majority of the Labour group on Avon County Council voted to increase the budget as normal, as they would in any other year, and that led to us being capped, and we had to make further cuts. So that was quite a significant incident, which made me rethink my thinking.
So what were you, for or against the poll tax? Because this is something...
I'm totally opposed to it, but I argued that we shouldn't punish the people we represented, but the vote within the group split 2-1. It was say just 36 Labour members, it was something like 24 against 12. It voted 2-1 in favour of continuing as normal with your normal budget making plans. But to me, representing Southmead, I felt like we couldn't see people who'd never had to pay it before be jailed or taken to court. And even though at the time I didn't advocate non-payment, I felt that some of the middle-class Labour Party members in Bristol were okay and comfortable and able to pay it, whereas the people in my constituency weren't, and I decided to try and stand up for their interests.
Moving a bit closer up to date, why did you decide to stand as a candidate for the Mayor on the particular ticket of Filton Airfield? Because, I mean, this is an issue we've discussed on air quite a lot. I mean, everyone across the city is scratching their heads about it. Why for you?
Right. Southmead Ward is the only part of Bristol which includes any part of Filton Airfield. As you may know, the Brabazon Hangar and Concord are actually located within Bristol City's boundaries.
Oh, are they? No, I didn't know that. Yeah, so right. The boundary goes across the airfield, is it, right?
No, it's separate. The runway is separated by a railway line, which is known as the Henbury Loop Line. And everything north of it is in South Gloucester. Everything south of it is in Bristol. But the part which is in Bristol relevant to the airfield, it was the old work site where they built Concord, where they built the Brabazon and the Brabazon Hangar. And Concord is also located in part, but that falls within my old ward. So I felt, as someone who was interested in saving the airfield, basically what it does is symbolises my belief in economic development and economic growth for the city. And I thought, how can a city which made its wealth from trade and industry through having its seaport allow something which within the 20th century led to major employment and major development in Bristol, which is Filton Airfield, just because it's outside the boundaries, how could we sit by? In the 19th century, the corporation bought rival ports. Bristol City bought Bristol's Docks Company. They bought Porter's Head because it was a rival port. Why couldn't they think about doing something to protect our economic future, which I believe Filton represents?
Now, BAE Systems, they would say the people that own that airfield now, even though originally, of course, it was a nationalised business and it became a privatised company who then started looking at asset stripping parts of their amazing amount of portfolio of property that they got as part of that privatisation. Mm. What about that side of things? I mean, why was it? Because they say, of course, the airfield didn't make a profit, so there's no way they could just carry on using it.
Well, they're wrong. We've got the last 2 years' accounts. Well, I say we, the Safe Filton Airfield campaign, has published the last 2 years' accounts, which are from Companies House, and they show last year there was about £500,000 profit, and the year before there was £1.2 million profit on the operating of the airfield. So they've just been telling blatant lies on that. They did inherit in a way, the airfield from what was previously a nationalised industry and benefited by paying it, you know, a small price to pay for it. I think it may even have been as little as a pound. But I don't know if there was a restrictive covenant on it. But they needed people politically to stand up. Unfortunately, South Gloucester Council are complicit in this. What they did is, because their need for housing, to meet the housing targets, they had to make a decision between either locating houses in rural parts with greenbelt or choosing one of the major brownfield sites in their area, which was the airfield, and rezoning it for housing. But it's such a short-sighted approach.
But hang on a minute, because whether or not they actually made money on it, because they may have invested in other ways, possibly that they didn't get back as a return, so they may still argue, oh, we didn't ultimately make a profit on the airfield. They're looking at it as a commercial decision. They can make a fortune selling that land to housing developers, and surely they're just looking at the pound signs, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And is that, why shouldn't they? I mean, that's what all businesses have to do.
Well,
especially in the current climate.
It may not be financially corrupt, but it's morally corrupt. If I was in government, but we're not, and I know that the Bristol Mayor couldn't nationalise it, but it should be looked after in the national interest. If there was a government which looks after, takes into account our future economic growth and aircraft manufacturing industry, then we could make a case for nationalising the airfield and keep looking at, on the grounds of national interest.
I'm afraid there's very little being nationalised right now, politically or financially. Very, very difficult. So, in a way, your Safe Filton airfield campaign is history, isn't it?
Not really, no. People are still fighting. We have to fight every plan and application. Every plan and application has to go through due process. We haven't got the outcome, the inspector's report. That is open to challenge. People in the campaign believe that they could take the inspectors the decision to judicial review because the procedures which South Gloucester have followed haven't been by the book, and there is a case to be answered there, and the campaign goes on.
GKN are still up there, Rolls-Royce are still up there, Airbus are still up there. Some of the people you speak to, though, aren't necessarily confident about how long their jobs are going to stay. Now, we've been promised by BAE, by Airbus, and by everybody else, that the fact that there's no longer a runway there isn't actually going to affect the aviation industry at Filton. What's your impression of... How true is that?
Well, not one manufacturing site, Airbus manufacturing site, is without a runway. Filton will be the first site. Now, in Airbus's in-house magazine, One, this October, they published a map of their worldwide sites, manufacturing sites.
Well, they certainly did, and you sent me this before the show, and I'll put it up online for people to have a look at afterwards, a PDF copy of it, a digital copy of that. And what we've got on here is a double-page spread of all of the... this is keeping Airbus on the move, it says, of all of the different manufacturing sites of the Airbus company. Now, just to run through them, in France, we've got Nantes, Toulouse, Saint-Nazaire, and in Germany, we've got Hamburg and Bremen. In Spain, we've got Cadiz, Seville and Getafe, I think that's pronounced, or Getafe. Even there's a place called Mobile in the USA, and Tianjin in China. In the UK, though, there's only one site, that's Broughton. There's no mention of Filton.
That's worrying, isn't it? This was published in October, 1 month before the mayoral election. We flagged it up during the Hustings debate. I don't know how the company has tried to explain it, but if you look at that map, it shows how they ship things from, say, Broughton. There's a container ship leaving Broughton in North Wales, going to Europe, as you can
see from
the quay. And why didn't they have an indication with Filton? Why wasn't Filton placed on that map? And why didn't it show a ship leaving Avonmouth? As they said, they're going to transport the wings by road to Avonmouth and then on a container ship to Europe, to France or Spain, for them to be constructed. But wouldn't it make more sense to continue with the airfield and fly them out on the Beluga as they have done in the past?
Well, there is actually an aeroplane on this map flying. It's one of those giant planes. How do they move these giant wings around? Is it in these kind of strange shaped, gigantic looking aircraft?
Yeah, that Beluga was recently seen at Filton because one of the final flights from the airfield.
Okay. But it's called a Beluga.
Yeah, right. They're showing the Airbus Beluga flying from Broughton on that map, aren't they? As well as container ships, yeah.
Yeah, that is pretty staggering that even Airbus don't seem to include Filton as one of their manufacturing sites. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Tim is suggesting that nationalisation is the only way, but ultimately that ain't going to happen, is it?
Well, when you said earlier that things aren't being nationalised, apart from the banking system, of course, which has been nationalised without any second thoughts, although we're not actually exerting any power over.
Hang on a minute, that's billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions.
A lot more than an airfield.
Right, so actually, if you think it that way, there's no reason why you shouldn't nationalise it. Do you think what do you think of the general idea, though, of selling off somewhere like Filton for housing? Because I mean, ultimately, you can't actually blame BAE. They're looking at this as a commercial decision, aren't they?
BAE used to be a nationalised company, and they wouldn't have been able to do that without getting the agreement of the government.
Yes, but they're not anymore, are they?
No,
I mean they are actually making a commercial.
That is one of the problems, isn't it? I'm not saying that you should. When you've got oligopoly production. I mean, when you've got you haven't got lots of small firms in this industry. You've got big firms dominate it with a change of subcontractors. Now, you either nationalise those firms, and of course, there's an argument in favour of that. There's also an argument if you're not going to nationalise them, you've still got to have a public interest regulation of what they do, because their decisions are going to have knock-on effects, which are not just free market decisions. I mean, basically, BAE, in a short-sighted way, could decide to build houses on this site, and then that leads to a situation where an industrial decline sets in the whole of Bristol region, which leads to knock-on effects for for generations to come. Now, that is not just a decision for those concerned; it's a wider decision, and this is the sort of thing Michael Heseltine might say. You know, the decisions of big companies are not just for those companies. There's got to be some kind of plan, some kind of strategy. And I think we've had a generation where we believe we don't have to have a strategy, but that's patently silly.
The market is supposed to sort these things out, isn't it? But it doesn't always do that.
The market is imperfect, as I've just indicated. It's not a free market, but when you're dealing with high technology, it very rarely is. In Japan, they would never have allowed some decision like that to be made at that level by the management of one firm. They just wouldn't have allowed it.
Yeah, can I just say, we saw an email from the Department of Transport questioning, saying that the closure of Filton Airfield could be a threat to regional investment. Now, we've been pressing at the door of Department for Business, we've been pressing Department for Transport to produce their regional airport strategy. The government have basically put everything on hold in order to do a quick fix to the economy by boosting housing numbers. That's the only infrastructure they're thinking about to stimulate the economy. They're not thinking about the growth industry of the aircraft manufacturing industry, which it is, but they're just thinking, quick fix, boost housing numbers. South Gloucestershire have rezoned the housing. In fact, the targets for South Gloucestershire are even increased by the exact number of what they're going to apply. They're going to build on the airfield. The quota for South Gloucestershire was upped by 2,500 to meet the number of houses which they could fit on the airfield.
Well, I can see why your campaign, even after the closure of the airfield, is still going strong, because there's still feelings are running
and
high.
On top of that, the people who live in, say, the Henbury South Mead side of the boundary of the railway line, and the people who live on the Patchway Filton side of the boundary line, they suffer with terrible bottlenecks of traffic up Cruise Causeway, near where I live at the Avon Ring Road, by the MOD. And what you're going to get is, for example, where I used to live, Charlton Road, where my father lives, 22,000 car movements a day for 2,500 houses. It works out the government. There's a recognised body in England which show you trip generation from developments, and tricks say there are 9 vehicle movements per day per household. So if you times 2,500, you get 22,500. And if you take in the greater area around there, there's about 8,000 houses, you're talking about 72,000 movements. And you know how bad the Malcribs Causeway, Junction 17, and the approach from Bristol Parkway Station.
Well, maybe there'll have to be a congestion charge up in Filton too. Mark Martin, this does smack of a lack of foresight.
Yeah, well, what you've got is people taking decisions which make sense to them in terms of maximising their short-run profit, but what about the general good? And I think ultimately we've got to get back to looking at the economy as a cooperation, if you like, between individual entrepreneurial decisions and wider plans. And if that sounds a bit sort of boring in 1960s, well, it is, because in actual fact we used to manage things quite well in that era.
I spoke to one of the young engineers up at Airbus at one of the public meetings, and he said, look, quietly, most of us up here think that our jobs are going to go, even though they've said that they won't. But we have had a bit of good news this week from Michael Ribbick at the Bristol Post. Workers at Rolls-Royce factory in Patchway are breathing a sigh of relief after it emerged they will not be affected by job cuts at the firm. The engineering company announced it's cutting around 400 jobs in its defence division as a result of government spending cuts. Fears were immediately raised that the cuts could affect the firm's operation in Bristol, largely based around defence and marine work. The unions were initially claiming that work could move abroad, but bosses at Rolls-Royce had moved to reassure the 3,000 workers in South Gloucestershire they will not be affected by the cuts. But it emerged that more work will be coming to Bristol as a result of the review, with the contract being transferred from a factory in Germany. Well, at least for Rolls-Royce, anyway, Tim, this is looks really reasonably good. But what about the other big companies up there, and what about Airbus? What's your knowledge or your views about whether those jobs are secure or not?
No, I believe that the order books are healthy. I believe there is future manufacturing work, but I just can't see how the company are going to continue to manufacture from the Filton site if they don't have a runway. It doesn't make sense. Every other manufacturing site of Airbus has a runway. If the merger had gone ahead between EADS and BAE Systems, I'm sure the company would have reconsidered the closure decision, because it would have been tipped in the balance of the Airbus manufacturings rather than the
systems. This is this massive European defence manufacturer, and there was a decision towards the end of last year that they shouldn't be allowed to merge because it would mean that it was too big and powerful a business. That was one of the main reasons. Anyway, on to some other news this week. Director admits chairing a blacklist group. This is from the Financial Times. Tim Pickard, a senior director at Sir Robert McAlpine Limited, has confirmed that he was the chairman of the Consulting Association, an unincorporated association which has been criticised for running a blacklist of 3,000 construction workers. Cullum McAlpine, I've heard that family name before. I think he was the treasurer of the Tory party, wasn't he, under Margaret Thatcher, who was wrongfully, we believe, we're not absolutely sure, but we think wrongfully accused of being involved in the Wrexham paedophile ring. Cullum McAlpine, who's obviously not the same chap, but from the same family, who has been a director of the company since 1970, said in a written statement to the Scottish Affairs Select Committee on Tuesday this week that he was appointed as chairman of TCA, the Consulting Association, by its founding members drawn from across the construction industry. His role to make sure it was set up on a secure and viable commercial and financial basis, and he confirmed he carried out that role from 1993 to 1996. This company, Martin, has been in the news this week because of this Scottish Affairs Select Committee having a very close look at these construction contracts. The irony here, of course, being that this is, of course, most of these contracts took place across Britain, including the Olympic contract, and yet workers who were reporting health and safety things over as part of their job were blacklisted from working on the Olympics in Britain. But it's being discussed by the Scottish Affairs Committee. Seems really bizarre. And certainly very uncomfortable that people are losing their jobs, losing their careers for simply reporting breaches in safety regulations.
Yeah, well, we think we live in a free society, but it's a very limited concept, isn't it? I mean, this kind of discrimination against active... I mean, it's not even active trade unions, is it? It's people who actually report any kind of health and safety violation, basically blacklisted from working in the industry. And we've seen also the Shrewsbury pickets in the 1970s. It's now come out that the government was behind, you know, the sending to prison of Des Warren and the other chap who was on Brookside, whose name I've forgotten. And, of course, we've also been hearing about the Metropolitan Police from 1968 infiltrating the sort of extra-parliamentary green movements to the extent of having 10 undercover officers who had 4 children with the women that they were targeting and then disappeared. And they're now saying that any complaints about this will have to be heard in secret. There has always been a state within a state in Britain, with big companies and those with power using the forces of the state to intimidate ordinary people. It's always been like that. It needs to change.
So how did this consulting association chaired by Cullum McAlpine get hold of all this intelligence? I mean, basically, it's like a Big Brother thing. A lot of the sort of information that was being held in their database on individual construction workers, electricians, builders and this kind of people was basically photocopies from police files.
Indeed. And what you should say to organisations which carry out actions like this is, if you do that, you're not going to get a public contract anywhere. That's the way you.
The trouble is, of course, that they have many public contracts still.
Indeed they do.
Tim, what's your thoughts on this story? I mean, it's been bubbling along for about a year or so since it was first revealed by the Information Commissioner raiding the offices of the Consulting Association and actually seizing this database that was being used to blacklist workers and to ruin their careers.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with any blacklisting of any worker or any organised collective of workers looking after their own interests, and it just reminds me of American companies and their practices, really.
Sir Robert McAlpine Limited also made payments to Ian Kerr, who actually ran the Consulting Association, after the group was closed down. Those payments were cheques for £15,000 and £8,000 to Mr. Kerr's daughters to cover their father's fines and legal fees. So an individual who was actually running this organisation day to day, McAlpine Limited, paid his fines and fees, and this poor chap, Ian Kerr, well, I say poor chap because he's died. He gave his evidence to the Scottish Affairs Committee last year and then very promptly died. So a whole thing is a little bit of a can of worms, isn't it?
It is, and you've got to remember that the construction industry is the most dangerous industry to work in. You know, hundreds of people every year die on building sites, so this is not a trivial matter.
I think, Tim, for me, one of the most appalling things about this story is the lack of contrition from these people. They seem to think that they were doing nothing wrong.
Yeah, well, they're not sorry, are they? They think it's fair game.
Okay, another bit of news this week. UK unemployment rate falls to 7.7%, but the wages stagnate below inflation. Number of people in work reached a record level in 3 months to last November, but wage rises stalled as employers kept a lid on pay packets, so says The Guardian on Wednesday. Martin, I'll start with you again here, because this was discussed on Question Time last night on the BBC One, and there was a sort of... should we say derision from the audience, really, with the Conservative woman who was on there, suggesting that, that actually it was nonsense, that there were less jobs around, or at least most of the new jobs were just part-time work.
Yeah, well, I mean, this has been confusing economists for quite a while, because, I mean, the economy supposedly shrank by 0.3% in the last quarter of 2012, but unemployment still seems to be coming down. Don't forget, we've still got 2.5 million unemployed. You know, we're not talking about everybody getting a job by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm old enough to remember when unemployment went over 1 million in Britain, and it was regarded as a kind of shocking, shock-horror moment, but we've never dipped below that in my lifetime. I think two things are going on, looking at it. One is, as you say, there's a lot of part-time work, and a lot of people are being included as employed if they're on schemes, that transpired the other week. So anybody who's on some kind of scheme or some kind of, you know, make work or like the work programme or whatever. So in any case, everybody expects that if we have a double-dip recession, unemployment is what economists call a lagging indicator. Yeah, it's the thing that gets affected last of all. So we're squeezing the last drops of employment out of the economy before we go into the double dip. And when we talk about double dip recession or triple dip recession, it sounds like a bit of a bump in the road. But the danger is, of course, that you actually just fall off the cliff completely, and the world economy is actually teetering on the brink of a collapse rather than just a sort of a bit of a slowdown.
Well, I wonder about these figures. And I think there's quite a lot of figure fixing going on. One of the things, for example, there were police crime figures out, national crime figures were out earlier this week, Tim, and one of the things which was in a small print at the bottom of the article I read was that actually quite a lot of crimes have been reclassified as less serious than they used to be, like the previous year or the previous year. So that's one of the ways that you can actually make the overall picture look differently. What are your thoughts about the general state of employment at the moment? Do you think there are enough jobs around, and do you agree that actually there's less unemployed people?
No, when you break it down, you'll find out there's another 2.5 million on the sick, which ironically back in the 80s Margaret Thatcher was quite happy with people to go on the sick because it massaged the unemployment figures, remember. Now it's the Tory government trying to boot everyone off the sick. They're going to go on to the unemployment numbers, aren't they? Although 40% of people win their appeals, so they're genuinely not sick and shouldn't have been kicked off in the first place. All statistics are massive, aren't they? Say the police figures. When I used to be a member of the Avon Somerset Police Authority, we were aware of something called the clear-up racket. You know, they get people to take into consideration certain offences. Not sold. And how about if you make an insurance claim, you have to get a crime report. You know, you try and report minor crimes nowadays, you get dissuaded from actually going ahead with reporting them.
So that's one way, I suppose, of changing those figures. The other thing, of course, is quite a lot of people who I've spoken to, I mean, this is just, and including myself in a way, because, I mean, I'm signing on, even though I only get about £6 a week or something, because I've got a part-time job, and so I go and sign on for Job Seekers Allowance. And over Christmas, I was just, I mean, I said this a couple of weeks ago, I was just told, oh, you didn't turn up for an interview, so we've removed you from the figures, and we've suspended your benefits. You know, basically stopped your benefits. Well, I actually didn't notice because it was only £6 that didn't appear in my account, and I didn't notice that particular week. But obviously, that doing that kind of thing is a form of bullying, really, to get people off of the figures. So I wonder if there is anyone else out there listening who is being bullied in that way.
Yeah, friends of mine.
Please do get in touch with the show, and we will have a look at your, you know, have a look at your cases, because, you know, I think when people are actually on the poverty line, when they have very little spare cash, maybe, you know, only £20 a week or something to buy food with, when they're put in that situation, it really is appalling for them to be bullied in that way. So we're quite happy to, you know, at least have a look at your cases, and also you can stay anonymous if you want to stay anonymous on this show. Right, on to our next story, and the Bristol Mayor, George Ferguson, has appointed his cabinet, Guy Pulteney, Barbara Jenk and Alistair Watson. This is the Lib Dems, Guy Pulteney and Barbara Jenk, who is the former leader of the City Council, Liberals, and Conservative Alistair Watson will take up the seats left by Labour, who declined to join Mr Ferguson's cabinet. Mr Pulteney is now responsible for housing and planning. Ms Jenk will take up health and wellbeing, while Alistair Watson's brief will be children and young people. So effectively, we've got a kind of Lib-Con coalition, haven't we, here in Bristol, just like at Westminster. Interestingly enough, the Green Party have commented today about this, saying, where is the new blood? Councillor Tess Green said the Mayor now has Simon Cook and Barbara Jenk, both former Lib Dem leaders, in his cabinet, along with Guy Pulteney, who also served in the last Lib Dem cabinet. We wish them well in their new positions, but we fail to see where the new ideas, which the Mayor claims to seek, will come from. Martin.
Well, I mean, it's, the developments in Bristol are interesting, to say the least. I mean, the suggestion that George Ferguson was suggesting that the Labour Party should join an all-party cabinet. It caused a bit of an internal convulsion inside the Labour group, as I understand it, not that I'm elected to anything. I think the odd thing about this is that the Greens are also in this cabinet, and they are going to find it very hard, I think, to stay with it, given the kind of policies that are going to have to be pursued. I mean, as I said last week, we've gone through this whole fuss of having a mayor. Are we going to have one? Aren't we going to have one? We're then going to elect one. And then in actual fact, it doesn't make any difference who's running it, because we've got to carry out £37 million worth of cuts this year anyway.
Well, this is
the same whoever was elected.
This is the peculiar thing, Tim, because we've got Councillor Simon Cook, who used to be the lead. This is effectively his budget they're implementing now. George Ferguson only had a couple of months after being elected mayor before the budget was announced. And also the cabinet is looks rather similar to the former Lib Dem cabinet. We also know that George Ferguson himself, even though he stood as an independent for this sort of tag name Bristol First Party, was right up until just before the mayoral election, actually a fully paid up member of the Liberal Party, which I think is a bit naughty of him, really, saying he's an independent whilst he's actually a member of the party that's ruling the city at the time. Now, what are your thoughts about the way this is all panning out, as we've got a cabinet which is doesn't seem to be, as the Green Party are saying here, where's the new blood?
No, I agree with that criticism, but I would have appointed a similar cabinet. He was forced to go along this route because he did offer free places to Labour, and the Labour Party said that they were instructed nationally. They probably weren't instructed nationally. When I was Secretary of the Labour Party, we had rules which were set by the National Executive, and probably the local party had a meeting. There was probably a resolution from one of the constituencies, and the district party, or what is called the Bristol Labour Party now, they discussed it and basically put a bar on their councillors taking positions in his cabinet. Okay, that's the position. I would have wanted to appoint three Labour members. I would have probably appointed two Liberals, two Conservatives, and maybe a Green, to make it proportionate to the votes in the election. And I congratulate my local councillor, Guy Pulteney, on achieving a place in the Cabinet, and some of the other members of that George's team may have been in my chosen Cabinet. So I think he's making the best of a bad job. I can see why the Labour Party decided not to take places in the cabinet. I think it's very, very hard for people personally, as they were the main opposition to George. It was George first, Labour Party candidate second. They felt that they'd rather be in opposition and stand there and make the administration accountable, George's administration accountable. He was left no choice but to appoint people from within. We can't point outsiders. For example, I know many people would have wanted to appoint a Green mayoral candidate. You know, other mayoral candidates spoke highly of different people in the cabinet.
But she's not actually a councillor.
But if you're not a councillor, you know, we could all put our hats in May, but unless we get elected as a councillor, we can't be part of the cabinet. So that's where the new blood will come from in May.
Tim's right, Martin, isn't he? Actually, the Labour Party have messed up doubly here, really. First of all, by losing the election in the first place, and secondly, failing to stand up and be part of this cabinet, even if it is only going to be for a short time until these elections in May. Surely the Labour Party are far better off, at least in there, being able to report back to the public what's going on and possibly having a fairly critical voice, rather than standing at the sidelines stamping their feet like children.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the Labour Party is a broad church, and in actual fact, so I believe Helen Holland and Mark Bradshaw were willing to join the cabinet, but of course I think George Ferguson went round it rather than the wrong way, which is that he started to pick people he wanted rather than going to the Labour Party as a party and saying, do a deal with us. Yeah, and I think in actual fact the problem is that there's a left and a right in the Labour Party. It was the regional national executive, I understand, who stepped in and said we don't want this. Now the National Executive Committee, most listeners probably don't realise, it's the only democratic bit of the Labour Party left, and it, you know, as a member I get to vote for who goes on it, and in actual fact your NEC both locally and nationally is far to the left, or a bit to the left of the national leadership.
Can you just explain that? That's the only democratic bit left. It sounds like it's you know, a bit of a sorry state of affairs as regards it not being a really democratic
party. Remember back into the 70s and the 80s, you know, Labour Party conferences were huge battles over policy. And there was, you know, everybody knew that the party members and the unions with their votes and all the rest of it would determine the policy. But of course that then led to a perception that the party was constantly at each other's throats, which was just no good. And eventually, you know, for very good reason, the Labour Party decided, look, we've got to actually streamline this so that we present ourselves in a unified fashion. I mean, this is a problem about presentation as well, because people ought to be able to put up with a bit of dispute without it turning into a huge issue. But of course, the NEC doesn't decide policy anymore, apart from on little things like this. This is the only time that they can, in fact, stick their oar in. And I think what you'll find is a lot of people in the Labour Party, the activists, will be saying, well, look, we don't want to be associated with this cuts policy. You know, so in many ways, I mean, if let's put it this way, if everybody was in the cabinet in Bristol and everything then goes to hell in a handbasket, as it may well, not for any fault of anybody's in Bristol, but because the economy's going down the drain, then who are the people going to vote for at the next election if all the parties are implicated in the mess? Now, I think it may be after May, after we've had the May local elections, this may be reconsidered. I think there was a big debate in the Labour Party about whether to go in or out of the cabinet for the reasons we're just saying. But I mean, the fact is that there is no real local democracy, and that, you know, at Bristol level, not a lot is decided that's of any great importance for ordinary people. The big decisions, like how much money is going to be spent, aren't made locally, and they haven't been for a long time. And so you then get a kind of delusionary democracy, and there's only how many people voted in the election? Maybe 30%, something like that. Maximum.
Yeah, 28% roughly.
Yeah, which is not out of line with local elections generally, but it's not a lot better either.
No.
So to claim that there's a huge mandate for what George wants to do, I think is slightly over-egging it.
On that point, I kept arguing during the election, because of the city deal, which was announced last summer, the government allow us to raise finances for capital programmes, obviously, for infrastructure spending, such as transport, roads, bridges, projects to stimulate the economy, from rates raised within our local enterprise zones. And one of my strategies for solving the problem with the Filton Airfield, that North Fringe area is a major industrial centre around Bristol, but it just happens to fall outside of boundaries. So I argued for a greater Bristol. So in effect, the Bristol Mayor or Bristol Council could control that area. Mm. And there's going to be a local enterprise zone there. South Gloucester wouldn't want to lose it because they will be able to raise revenue against the rates raised there, keep them. For example, within our proposed zones, say next to Temple Quarter, yeah, Temple Meads, Temple Quarter, if, say, the BBC moved from White Ladies down to Temple Quarter, the rates there can be used, kept in Bristol's coffers, not go to London, be spent by central government. They can be borrowed against. We can raise revenue against it and spend within the economy to stimulate Bristol further. Okay? But what, there was a lot of confusion in the election. This is why I do want to cover this point about cuts, because we were all asked to face it in a major debate a few days before the election. And I said, why, for example, are we being asked as candidates to say how we're going to make the cuts? Why don't you look at it from a different approach? How can we as a city generate income? Because I gave you that strand on the capital side where the government had given us the facility to raise money by encouraging inward investment, encouraging companies to move to Bristol. I don't just want, say, the BBC to move from Clifton to Temple Quarter, because that's just not boosting our economy, really. However, it may have a magnet effect. It may lead to, like it did in Manchester and Media City, it may lead to further inward investment within the city, so it may be worthwhile.
I hate to say it, Tim, but it looks to me as if businesses are leaving rather than coming. But anyway, let's move on now to look at the big political event of the week, if you can call it that, and that was David Cameron's speech in Berlin about Europe. I mean, this has been, I think it was the fifth promise of it actually being delivered, and finally it was. Now, the actual end result of what he had to say, or summarise, is saying we're putting it off any kind of referendum on Europe for 4 or 5 years, which to me is not a very decisive way of doing things. Also, there's no promise at all that David Cameron is going to be in charge, and any more than he may be in coalition, or he may, you know, in fact, it's very unlikely he's going to be in charge. So what does this speech really mean after the general election? Yeah. And the other thing, of course, is will he actually do what he said he'd do? Because obviously before the general election, he promised to have a referendum. He hasn't had a referendum. To add insult to injury, though, at question time on Wednesday as well, David Miliband also said that they didn't want a referendum. So Ed Miliband said that the Labour Party wouldn't want to have a referendum either. So certainly this seems to be a bit of a stitch up on the British public once more, where nobody is going to offer a referendum on Europe. So anyway, an insulting speech really, to say that he's going to put it off for 4 and 5 years where he may not be in charge anyway, and also after the broken promises of last time. But let's have a listen now. I did a little edit. It was a very long and very, shall we say, turgid speech, which is the sort of thing you might want to listen to if you're suffering from insomnia late at night, which would probably help you nod off. But anyway, I've done a couple of minutes of some of the most important, some of the most important points that David Miliband made in Berlin on Wednesday morning.
Now, if we don't address these challenges, the danger is that Europe will fail and the British people will drift towards the exit. I do not want that to happen. I want the European Union to be a success. And I want a relationship between Britain and the European Union that keeps us in it. That is why I'm here today, to acknowledge the nature of the challenges we face and to set out how I believe the European Union should respond to them, and to explain what I want to achieve for Britain and its place within the European Union. So let me start with the nature of the challenges we face. First, the Eurozone. Now, the future shape of Europe is being forged. There are some serious questions that will define the future of the European Union and the future of every country within it. Second, while there are some countries within the EU that are doing pretty well, taken as a whole, Europe's share of world output is projected to fall by almost a third in the next 2 decades. As Chancellor Merkel has said, if Europe today accounts for just over 7% of the world's population and produces 25% of global GDP, it is currently financing 50% of global social spending. And then it's obvious that it will have to work very, very hard to maintain its prosperity and its way of life. Third, there is the growing frustration that the EU is seen as something that is done to people rather than acting on their behalf. People are increasingly frustrated that decisions taken further and further.
Now, I really have to start talking over David, I'm afraid, because, I mean, he really does go on into I can only describe as it is a little bit difficult to understand why he would just continually talk about something where, first of all, he's putting this referendum off for 4 to 5 years, and he's saying basically, look, nobody likes Europe, but we're going to still put up with it for another 4 or 5 years. Tim, what are your thoughts about the whole sort of deal that the British public have got, because we signed up whatever it was in 1975
maybe 72, to, but a referendum
to the European Economic Community, something called the Common Market. This is something very different. It's political integration, it's legal integration. Much of the new legislation that's coming into this country, many of the laws to do with trade are actually being we're being told what to do by Brussels, and there's a real dilemma as to whether the rule is by Brussels or by Westminster, and the British people still haven't been asked which they want. And they're getting nothing from Cameron. He's saying, oh, it's going to be another 4 or 5 years before we make a decision, and when I may not be in power.
Yeah, well, I just think that there's no doubt about it that Cameron will probably come out in the establishment camp and be in favour of staying in Europe. Martin and I both remember the 1975 referendum, and the public voted 2-1 staying, but they allowed people in the cabinet, they allowed a breakdown, accepted cabinet responsibility, where different members of the same Labour government allowed to campaign on the other side. You'd have Roy Jenkins on the pro-European side, you'd have Tony Benn in Bristol on the anti-European side, and we had a good debate. We need the same debate again. The good thing about this proposal, that if there will be a referendum, even though it wouldn't take place until the following Parliament, is that it actually is giving the electorate a chance to choose a party. I know you can vote UKIP, and that's why the problem, because at the last election, both all the Liberal Dems, the Labour Party and the Conservatives, there wasn't any difference between them. They're all pro-European. From an economic, I'd like to hear Martin's views from, you know, I'm not saying a little English, but I'd like to know from an economist's point of view. I mean, I know that we can make certain decisions using our own sovereignty within Britain's economy. We're very lucky that we stayed out of the European
Exchange. Europe.
Yeah, we're very lucky that we didn't stay in the exchange rate mechanism of joining the Euro, yeah? So
We know what the Greek people think, because they're out rioting from time to time on the streets, saying what they think of being controlled by Brussels and having their currency controlled by the euro rather than their own country. But Martin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the fact is that these questions are, in fact, pretty complicated. I mean, you say that we joined the European Economic Community, but, of course, the Maastricht Treaty, signed by John Major's Conservative government, created the European Union, which is what we're talking about.
Right, OK, so, but at the time, Margaret Thatcher refused to sign that, and many people would say that was one of the reasons she was elbowed down sideways.
Well, you can see, let's put it this way, there is a real danger that the banking system is going to collapse. One of the ways in which the banking system could collapse, and only one, it could be I think it's probably going to be the Americans, the US economy that's going to crash it in the end, but a euro exit, for example, by the Greeks could crash the banking system. And it's not about the euro at all now. Now, what you've got is politicians on the continent of Europe saying, we are just trying to stabilise this line which has hit an iceberg, and you're arguing whether you want to be on the liner or not. Now, in actual fact, you're on the liner, and you're going down. And all this argument about what we're going to do in 2015 after David Cameron wins the next election, which he's not going to do, he's definitely not going to win the next election. There's no way, no chance. They might be the biggest single party, maybe, but they're definitely not going to win outright. I can't see that. And I think that the people's discussion about this, when you actually say, let's have a referendum, do we like the French or not? Now, let's explain. Norway is outside the European Union. They've always been, they've had every opportunity to join, all their neighbours belong to it, and they've had a good look at it and said, no, too much free market for us, we want to keep our high minimum wages, our control of our industries, our nationalised oil industry. We talked about nationalised industries earlier. Statoil is probably one of the most successful companies in the world. It's run by the Norwegian government for Norwegian profit. They've got a huge sovereign wealth fund, which last week decided it wouldn't invest in any British company involved in the production of nuclear weapons. Now, that is Norway outside the EU.
And they still trade within.
But the point is, the point I'll finish now, the point I'm trying to make about this is that the Norwegians, If they didn't, they have to contribute to the EU budget. You know why? Because otherwise there will be tariff barriers against their exports into the EU. And in order to avoid having tariff barriers on their exports into the EU, they've had to do a deal with the EU to contribute to the EU budget more per head than we do. But they don't have any say on what that budget's spent on. Now, they'd rather be outside than in, so they're prepared to make to pay that price. But if Britain left the EU, the tariff war would go up at Dover, so that British companies would have to pay a tariff to get their goods into the EU, unless a deal was done for us to pay into the EU budget like the Norwegians have done. But it would still cost pretty much the same as it costs now, but you wouldn't have any say. That's the issue. And I think also business is going to say, well, the business from outside the world locates here in Britain because because Britain's language is very useful, but we're inside the EU. And this is what the Obama administration said: you go outside the EU, you can whistle for US investment. Now, I'm not saying we should go in or out, but people shouldn't think that this is an easy decision. And don't forget the real problem that people should be facing, and this includes the Prime Minister, is there's going to be a banking collapse. Never mind what's going to happen to the euro in 20 years.
Just given
time.
The banking collapse, Martin, which you, I mean, it has to be said, you've been predicting this for years now, still hasn't happened. But would it make sense, surely? I mean, it makes sense to be run by Westminster, doesn't it, if something like that happens, rather than by a faraway power in another country? I mean, surely you want, if you do have a very serious economic crisis with simply businesses falling like flies, I mean, we have actually seen the beginnings of that looking at our high streets, but that surely makes sense to have that controlled locally rather than centrally from Brussels, doesn't it?
Well, Cardiff as opposed to London, perhaps, or in any case, in actual fact, the people who run this country aren't based in Brussels, they're based in Washington, and that's what, and we've got masses of US bases on our soil, which drags us into wars we don't want to be involved in. If we're going to liberate this country, perhaps we should leave NATO. Do we want to have a referendum on that? Oh no, we can't talk about that. Perhaps we should.
Okay, on another story this week, and that is to do with a young man who died at home after nurses gave him 21 times too much medication instead of a teaspoonful. This is in the national press, as well as, I think it was on Points West as well this week. Joshua died after given 84 millilitres of clozapine instead of 4 millilitres, the post-mortem examination was shown. Two nurses were arrested and charged with the manslaughter, but the case was later dropped. Nurses have been suspended by Somerset NHS Trust and are under investigation from the Trust and Nursing Midwifery Council. Joshua Gaffney died at home shortly after a drug was administered, allegedly in the presence of mental health nurses Amanda Young and Petia Gummer. The patient died after being given an overdose of 6 bottles of medication when he was described less than a teaspoon of it, the report found. Joshua Gaffney, 22, should have received less than a third of a 15 milliliter bottle, had 21 times the prescribed amount of the drug. He died at home in Yeovil, Somerset, shortly after the liquid was administered, allegedly in the presence of these mental health nurses. A post-mortem examination and toxicology report found Joshua died from acute clozapine toxicology after being given 84 millilitres instead of just 4 millilitres. Well, obviously a terrible accident, but apparently charges against the nurses, at least not so far. Tim, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, it's terribly tragic, isn't it? I mean, I know cases where people have been in the chemist and been given someone else's dose of methadone. Could have died. 35 milligrams of methadone would have been enough to kill anyone, and you know, survive, fortunately. But I don't know how. I mean, is it because with the NHS, really, we don't hold the nurses and the practitioners and the doctors accountable like you would in the USA, where there's a litigation climate, isn't there? There's an atmosphere of litigation in everything in America, but here we don't seem to have it. I don't know about criminal charges. I just think it sounds like a very sad accident.
The family feel very let down, Martin. The nurses who work out of Summerlands Hospital in Yeovil have been suspended by their employer, Somerset Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. They're subject to separate investigations by the Trust and the regulator, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, who placed restrictions on them. Report of a condition of practice hearing from Mrs. Gummer said the panel noted that she denies the allegations. However, having considered the serious nature of these allegations, which involved a gross inaccuracy in drug administration, the panel considered there's a real risk of repetition of the alleged behaviour should she continue to practice.
Well, I mean, these specific cases, as Tim says, it's just tragedy, isn't it? I mean, it may be it's such a large overdose that there's something mentally wrong with the mental health nurses, but who knows? I mean, really, it is something. Things like this need to be properly investigated. There's no use us sitting here and saying scoring political points on the back of it. I mean, basically, this is clearly wrong. Something's gone wrong, and you know there should be transparency in dealing with the consequences. And I take your point about litigation. I mean, if for example the NHS was sued and they had to pay out, that would just be the government or ourselves paying out anyway. Yeah. So I mean that doesn't really solve your problem.
Well, at least it maybe alleviates some of the problems for the family and makes them feel that someone cares after such a tragic accident. Anyway, over back to the House of Commons now. And this is also from Prime Minister's Question Times, talking about real poverty. This is MP Geraint Davis.
Geraint Davis. Mr. Speaker, a Swansea constituent of mine with a chronic medical condition tells me that he has just £20 a week to spend on food and clothing after paying his utility bills, and that after the welfare cuts in April, he'll just have £2 a day. If the Prime Minister believes that we're all in it together, will he agree to review the impact on the very poorest of the welfare cuts so that my constituents' sacrifices are in line with his own?
Well, I look very closely at what the Honourable Gentleman says and the circumstances, but let me just make the point. If you compare 2013 with 2010 in terms of the level of key benefits, it is worth making this point. An unemployed person on Job Seekers Allowance is getting £325 more this year than in 2010. A couple on Job Seekers Allowance, £500 more. A single out-of-work mother, £420 more. So what the opposition try and do week after week is somehow paint a picture that we have unfairly cut welfare is simply not true.
Well, that was a rather cheap answer from Mr. Cameron there, because all he's talking about is inflation increases of the benefits over an entire year period, talking about hundreds of pounds for someone who's unemployed. Obviously, that's what happens when you have inflation. So the basic benefits, anyway, used to go up, Martin, didn't they?
They did. I think this whole argument about fairness or unfairness, I understand why we're doing it, and don't forget that the government itself decided to have a vote on this to force the Labour Party to vote against so that they could be accused of being on the side of the shirkers as opposed to the workers. But I'd like to make a macroeconomic point, because what's happening is that wages are being cut, benefits are being cut, and you know what that is? That's sawing off the branch you're sitting on if you're talking about the economy as a whole. In Iceland, where they've only got 300,000 people and maybe, you know, a fairly large proportion of them are unemployed because of the crisis, they've increased unemployment benefits, because that's what you do in a crisis.
Tim, could you live on £2 a day food-wise?
No. I once broke down when I once was on unemployment benefit, £77 a week, and I was £11 a day, and it was this ridiculous amount to live on. But can I just quickly say on it, Martin's exactly right. In Japan, when they didn't have any spending in the economy, they gave everyone money from the Treasury, and they didn't spend it, actually, they saved it, didn't they?
Yeah.
But with people on benefits, people have a marginal propensity to consume greater than one, which means they spend more than what they have, so they would spend it back in the economy.
Okay,
exactly.
We're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, former councillor for Bristol and Avon, and Bristol Mayor candidate from the Save Filton Airfield campaign, Tim Collins. After the news, it's the World Economic Forum, the rich and powerful schmoozing away. But who runs the World Economic Forum?
2. Available online and on your mobile at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6.